I know. That's why ignorance is blessed, man.
You made me laugh so hard.
They were a good group, though. Hmm? I thought they were a good group, the presenters.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. It was
wonderful. They had a typical, you know, English sense of humor. And
yeah.
Okay, go. You ready?
Mm-hmm. All right.
It's October 25th, 2018, and I call the Cole High School District Board of Education to order. It's now 4:30. Roll call, please. Dr. Mitchell.
Perfect. Lynn Ebenkamp.
Here.
Angelina Pride.
Present.
David Malkin.
Present.
Donna Friedman.
Here.
Carrie Chen.
Here.
All board members are present.
Thank you. Any changes or items before from agenda?
None.
Okay. So I need a motion and a second to adopt the agenda. Board study session on Thursday, October 25th, 2018.
I'll make a motion.
I'll second.
Angelina Pry make the motion and Don Freeman seconds. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, flag salutes. Board member Ms. Pai, would you please lead us?
Please rise for the salute. Right hand over your heart. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States.
Thank you. Dr. Mitchell, any comments?
Yes, there are two requests to speak.
The remarks are limited to 3 minutes, unless extended to further, or limited by votes of the board. A maximum of 20 minutes, unless extended by the board, is allocated for each subject discussed. Ordinarily, board members will not respond to the presentations, and no action can be taken. However, the board may give direction to staff following the presentation. Mr. Humphrey?
Okay, board members, thank you for all the good things you do. But item number one is the term civility must be removed from the district lexicon. The willful obstruction of citizens' right to video record the public meetings by Alex Flores, Dennis Bexler, and with board member David Malcolm in attendance, and the ambushing of the personnel commission by Superintendent Mitchell and Dennis Bexler, which can be seen on my YouTube channel, by the way, attest to the hypocrisy of the district and use of the term civility in any form. I'm eternally grateful for the two teachers who gave their 3 minutes of fame last meeting for the program failure to effectively deal with disruptive behavior, which have been chronicled throughout the state and on many publications and Ed Source, as for Mr. Malcolm's perspective on sacrificing the many for the few. This endeavor has been chronicled, as noted, and the idea that this is to be a positive approach is just ludicrous from a district that as the no toilets district, and that Mr. John Peterson of the ARE, the teachers union, has documented that they can't even do the math. As to most recently, the Montebello Unified School District has had a FACMAT report, which they have referred parties to the district attorney for criminal prosecution. Yes, this is nothing to do until the guilt. Nothing will change until the guilty parties are sent, spend some time, quality time in jail. Which brings us to the Roland Heights Unified School District 2008 FACMAT report, which Superintendent Mitchell wants to hold in great disregard, and for which I feel should allow some to have some joint quality time with those over in Montebello. Nothing will change until these persons are held responsible and allowed to pay the piper. The administration and the Bond Oversight Committee are jointly guilty for not publishing Harry Peterson's swan song as required by law, and Natalie Moreno should be required to resign immediately along with Denise Jackman. And as they say, nothing is hidden except to be revealed, nor has anything been secret but that it would come to light. And I got 20 seconds. This district fails to video record. That's why I'm doing it here, and you can see it on YouTube, which is the 21st century standard for transparency, which is a buzzword for this district. Yet you go to that voice situation that they have on there, and it is an abomination. And I think that each district board member should give up a 1 month's pay, and the tech department should give up $1,000 for that abomination. Thank you.
The next is Mr. Shane Lohman.
Good evening, Board. Over the past few years, it's become obvious that our RUSD Board of Education has undergone a process of better defining their role. It's been clear based on discussions over items such as a board handbook that is currently being developed and the restructuring and the restructuring of school board meetings. All of this is positive, extremely positive, and we commend the board for undergoing this process. I believe that as our board continues to evolve, it's essential to understand our primary role as an oversight body and not a public relations or a cheerleading body. While there is a time and place for cheerleading, that should not be the primary function of our school board. I'm not making an argument that the board has not provided oversight, and I am not making an argument that the board does too much cheerleading. What I am making an argument that we need to be on constant guard to defend ourselves against mediocrity. We must challenge ourselves to go from good to great as an organization. As I reflect on some of the lowest points of our organization, I'm reminded of a board at that time that set aside their oversight role. And this led to a period of disarray due to the lack of accountability. It is essential that the board always ask tough questions and hold leaders accountable, even and especially me as a union president and Dr. Mitchell as a superintendent. You are the voice of this community, and you're expected to ensure that the diverse community of RUSD has shared governance within our systems and structures. If you have concerns about things like student achievement, you have to ask for more details. Ask questions such as, what is the governance structure at the school? Ask for this explained and then confirm what you were told. Is this structure conducive to student achievement? Have teachers been implementing the instructional shifts in their classroom? And if they're not, are they supported and coached by their principals? Are they given the proper training and resources to implement these shifts? Is our evaluation system with staff aligned to student achievement? Are the class sizes and student-teacher contacts at the recommended levels that the state believes is appropriate? Ask to see the comparisons. How is student attendance impacted by achievement? Ask to see attendance data for schools that you have concerns about. How has staff turnover impacted these scores? Ask to see how staffing has changed at different schools in recent years. Are students placed in appropriate classes? How have our special education services changed, and how does this impact student achievement? Is staff held accountable when mistakes are made? Do we learn from our mistakes? These are just an example of the types of questions that you should be asking. There are, of course, countless others that can be asked as well, and the association would like to continue to work with you on an ongoing basis to find answers to these questions and develop new ones as we continue to work together to increase student achievement. Thank you.
That's it. Okay. No more? Okay. Next item. Desiree Cervantes, please.
Thank you, board members, for allowing the students of Nogales High School the opportunity to speak. My name is Desiree Cervantes. I am here for a multitude of reasons, but first and foremost to advocate for myself, my peers, and future Nogales students. As IB students, we have been placed in a very difficult situation because if graduation were to occur today, 25 IB students would not be graduating with our peers because of our refusal to achieve or put forth effort in learning. But because courses at Nogales High School have changed without the consideration of the impact on our course loads in the junior and senior year. This is a procedure failure at the administrative level at Nogales High School. This choice has undermined the educational rights of 25 IB students, IB seniors to be exact, and will continue to cause lasting damage unless a solution is achieved swiftly and purposefully. The IB team has put together a list of our grievances and admonished the board to act and protect future Nogales High School students from becoming non-grads. To begin, the current Nogales seniors have been burdened with last-minute Aventa government and econ class. And that is a case that we already know that we can't fight that anymore. But I'm here to fight for my future IB students and Nogales students as well. My sister, she is a sophomore, and she's currently debating whether to be an IB, and I don't want that to be another future Nogales High School student. What we want is to be able to have a solution to this problem as fast as possible, because we need our students to have this opportunity to be able to not to just take these classes over the summer, because as of now, we don't have a college counselor at Nogales High School. And so these students over the summer can be exposed to college access programs. Yes, not all of them get accepted, but at least they have the opportunity to. And this is something that is very prevalent in our community, being first-generation people of color at Nogales High School. Another worry is the fact that our students are going through this caseload of CAS hours, extended essay, internal assessments, and other extracurriculars, and we just want this to be handled with. We want the people who are responsible for this to take accountability for this. We aren't supposed to be taking responsibility for mistakes that weren't in our control. We want to be able to have people take accountability for what they have done to us. We want our teachers to be able to focus on just teaching us, and we don't want to have to be worrying about if we're going to be graduating or not. We want to be able to challenge ourselves freely. Another concern that we have is that we want a more efficient history program at Nogales High School, especially for that. We appreciate your time.
Let me make sure they look into this one. The next one is your Luis.
Dr. Mitchell, would you please have staff meet with the students today who have this concern and give the board a feedback?
And also, Dr. Mitchell, I know that you're working on this now, but when she mentioned the plan to prevent reoccurrence, if we can get that when you have that developed. Okay.
So, the fact that we have to take I'm finishing off for her, by the way. The fact that we have to take an Aventa class in order to compensate for the lack of time that we have to take these classes can only be a detriment to things such as our GPA and our time, because as an IB student too, having to take an Aventa class on top of everything else that we're taking is just an unnecessary burden that could have been handled 3 years ago, when the papers or whatever was filled go along with that. Also, the lack of a solution for current juniors who lack those classes are worse than ours, and thus this issue needs to be resolved. What I was told by our principal was that in order to take these, or in order to fulfill ourselves with these classes, compulsory summer school classes must be taken. But how is that possible if there are other college preparation activities that are available only during the summer, those including Pays, Boulevard, Pepperdine leadership programs, overnight stays at UCs, et cetera, et cetera? The majority of those may not be able to attend, but that's not all. They may also have obligations elsewhere in their personal lives, and to compromise that on top of the obligatory summer work given on top of car hours, CAS hours, and to not graduate over the fact that we did not have time to take these classes is ridiculous and overbearing. The punishment for genuinely preparing ourselves for college, which is the case for high school, and the sole goal of that punishment is not graduating, it just doesn't make sense. So, also, another thing I want to bring up is our almost abysmal counseling program that does not offer itself to be presented clearly as to what we're able to do for students who have experienced mental issues, mental health issues, or even, like my colleague said, being able to know how to apply for college, apply for anything, because recently our college advisor was taken away for no reason whatsoever, and that hasn't been compensated with. And frankly, we want to know when these things will be resolved, not just for right now, not for it to be an isolated case, but like we said, for the future of not just IB students, but also AP students who, in my opinion, have it way harder than I do, for most case. And if we're able to get these answers, I want to know when, how, and if we're given these answers and it's still not applied with, how will we be able to hold administration accountable, and what action will be taken furthermore? Thank you.
Okay, the next item is the report. We have a report on California assessment of study performance and progress, CASP information and data. Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you very much. This afternoon, President Chen has shared, we are here to talk about the CASP, the California Assessment information. And so we have Dr. Brian Huff, who will lead us in our conversation and discussion around our assessment scores. And then we do have our Ed Services team around the table as well that will participate and engage in the conversation with the board.
Okay, good afternoon, board, superintendent. We are going to dive into the latest results of our CASP test scores. And we now have 4 years of data. So this has really given us a chance to kind of dig in a little bit deeper on some different ways and look at the data in different ways. So we're going to walk through these latest results from the 2018 SBAC test. So as you know, the Smarter Balanced Assessment System is actually three different components. There's the summative test that we give at the end of the year, the interim test that teachers use throughout the year, and we use some of those for our benchmark tests, and then the digital library. So we're just looking at the summative test scores that are given at the end of the year. First set of data we're going to look at are the results, the overall results in English language arts. And as you may remember, these results are presented on a four-level scale. So level 1, 2, 3, and 4. Level 1 is standard not met, 2 nearly met, 3 standard met, and then 4 standard exceeded. So this first chart shows the overall results of Roland Unified compared to the state and the county. And each bar shows the percentage of students that either met or exceeded. So when we talk about met or exceeded, that's these top two levels, so level 3 and level 4. So if we look at Roland in 2018, 50.73% of students that were in grades 3 through 8 and grade 11 met or exceeded. So they were on grade level or above grade level on the English language arts assessment. This is up from last year's score of 49.83 and down from 2 years ago, 52%, and then up from the very first year, 2015, at 46%. So what you see then compared is the county results and California overall, which we are slightly outperforming both state and county. The next slide shows this data broken down by grade level. And we're going to look at the grade level data in two different ways. This first time is going to be by year over year. So what this chart shows is for the past 4 years, how did grade 3 students do each year? So they're different groups of students. So if we look at, we'll just start with grade 3. And this is, again, year over year data. And again, we're also looking at percentage of students that met or exceeded, so that we're on grade level or above. So if we look at grade 3 students, last year, our grade 3 students, 49% of them met or exceeded. The year before that, third grade students, so different group of students, 45%. So we went up compared to the prior year in grade 3. The year before that, 48%, and then our baseline year, grade 3 students in 2015. Again, these are all different groups of third graders. So if we look at the four-year trend, 39% went up, went down a little bit, and then we ended up at 49. So overall going sort of in a up trajectory. You can see the same results for each grade level year over year. And if you go year by year, you can see some grade levels, like, for example, grade 6 started at 46%, jumped up to 52, and then the last 2 years have gone down a little bit. All of the grade levels, if we look at the first year of our baseline year of 2015 compared to the most recent year, 2018, some of the grade levels have gone up and down, but they all have shown growth if we look at that four-year comparison. The next slide I'm going to show you summarizes that four-year comparison. So if we look at ELA in grades 3 through 8 and 11, you can see what that four-year change is. And if you notice, you go down the grade levels, grade 3 jumped 10 points over the last 4 years. Grade 4, 9, 5. Grade 5 increased by 5 points. And then down the line, 3, 5, 1, and 1. So we see the biggest change over the 4 years at the elementary levels. Secondary levels over the past 4 years have also improved by 1 point, you know, grade 5 points in grade 7, 1 point in grade 8 and 11. But overall in ELA, we do see some increase. Now, another way to look at this data is by looking at what we call cohort matched data. So this next slide, slide number 9, shows the data a little differently. It actually follows the same group of students year over year and how they performed on the SBAC test. So why don't we start with grade 3 again? We'll go through a few of them together and we can talk about some of the trends that we're seeing. So this is titled 2018 grade 4 cohort data here on the left. And you can see the grade 4 students in 2018, 49% of them met or exceeded. Now, the year before that, if they were in fourth grade in 2018, they were in 2017, they were in third grade, right? So this, for the fourth grade cohort, when they were in third grade, 45% of them were meeting and exceeding. So as we go across each grade level, it shows the same group of students over time. So let's move to grade 5 and talk through what that looks like. So if grade 5 students, if this group of students were in grade 5 in 2018, in 2017, these students right here were in grade 4, and then in 2016, they were in grade 3. So if we follow this over time, in grade 3, 48% met. When those third graders went to fourth graders, they dropped down 4 points to 44%. When those same group of fourth graders moved into fifth grade, they jumped up to 52%. We moved to sixth grade. Since we have 4 years of data, we can go all the way back 6, 5, 4, grade 3 here. So when they were in third grade, because that's the first year that they take the SBAC test in 2015, 39% of those third graders met or exceeded. Fourth graders enrolling, that in 2016, 48%, they jumped up 9 points. The next year, as fifth graders, they dropped down 1 point, and then as in 2018, they jumped up 2 points to 49%. So I won't go through each grade level, but you can you get the idea that, so like if grade 7, this is grade 7, so you backtrack 6th, 5th, and 4th. Grade 8, we have grade 7, 6, and 5. And then this is the first year we're able to look at that kind of data for our grade 11 students. And so let's look at grade 11. In grade 11 last year, 60% of our grade 11 students enrolling met or exceeded. They don't take the test in grade 9 and 10, so we've got a gap here. That's why there are no bars here. But those group of 11th graders last year, when they were in, if we go back, so this would have been 10th grade, 9th grade, and then 8th grade. In 8th grade, 49% of them met or exceeded. So that's a jump of 11 points. So when we look at the ELA data, there is, again, some going up and down. We've got, you know, 6th grade that kind of went up and down. We've got 7th grade that jumped up the second year and then came down. But if we compare again from the first year of data we have to the second year, we see overall in ELA there's some growth in the matched cohort data as well. Now we're going to shift to overall in ELA. We've been looking at the overall scores. ELA also presents the results in four different domain areas, so reading, writing, speaking and listening, and research inquiry. These claim scores are presented a little differently. The results are presented a little differently than the overall scores. If you remember, the overall scores have four levels. The claim scores only have three levels. And that's because there are fewer items for them to create a score with, so they can't have as many performance levels. So the performance levels for, I'm going to jump to slide 12 just to remind us of what the three different levels are for claim scores, then we'll go back to slide 11. But these are, this is slide 12, and these are our 2018 results for our four different claim scores. So if you look at the bottom here, this is how they're presented. Again, the overall scores are four levels. The claim scores here, you can see, are below, near, and above. And so each claim score here is presented with a light blue are the percentage of students that are below standard, near, and above. As we take a look at this data, the claim level, our claim over the past 4 years that has been the lowest, the claim with the most students below, has been reading. And so part of the reason why we have our benchmark assessments that address reading informational reading literature is because this has been our claim that we have struggled with the most. You'll also notice that listening has the fewest number of students that are above. So again, that's one of the reasons why our benchmark assessment gives exposure to students who have to those kind of item types. So I'm going to go back a slide and show you some year-over-year data. I'm now back on slide 11. And slide 11 shows both the near and above combined. This is just showing students that are near or above standard for reading, writing, listening, and research and inquiry. This is how we have shared this data with you over the last 3 years, so I wanted to keep it consistent. And what we see is that the claim score that has shown relative to the other claim scores, the most growth is the reading claim. So we went from 67% 2015 to 70% near or above in 2018. The other claims have remained relatively flat. So 72, so around 72, around 80 for listening, and 78 for research and inquiry. So I'm going to pause here and just ask if there are any questions about the ELA section before we move on to math.
Often when I see on the charts for 2016, that 2016 seemed to be a better year out of the 4 years. Did something happen after 2016? Or did they is it a new test? Did they recalculate the test? Or
so the year, that, well, in 2017, there was statewide, we went down. If you remember, I don't know if you remember, there was a really big delay in the results in 2017. I think it was like October, November. They didn't even push the results out. So statewide, the results went down, also across all 13 states that give the Smarter Balance test. There was a slight decline in all of those states. So it's part. I think it's part of just when you're developing a new test and norming, there's going to be some of that happen. But yeah, so that's not wasn't just Roland that went down that year. It was a statewide average dip, and then across the 13 states and that give the SBAC.
Okay, and then on chart number 9, that one there. Now, that's the same group of students going across in each one of those categories, right?
Correct.
Now, do we have...
Let me rephrase that. Okay. So it is the same. So these are all the third graders that tested in Roland.
Right.
And then these are all the fourth graders that tested in Roland. So there's going to be some in and out of students that disenrolled or enrolled. So there may be some fourth grade. There are some fourth graders in this bar that joined Roland in sometime during fourth grade and are part of that test. The majority of them were with us, but because of our mobility, there are some students that left from this third grade cohort and some students that were added in that fourth grade.
That makes it difficult to draw any conclusions then, because the student coming in, you don't know what level he's functioning when he mm-hmm. comes in, okay. versus the student that's been with us continuously.
Yeah, and so I think what you're asking, we have that ability. This is from the CDE, what's reported mm-hmm. at the state level, and it's all the third graders, all the fourth graders. We have the ability through our systems, and teachers can, and schools have, and they have been, where you can run a true cohort match report where you can see just the students who have scores in both of these that were in Roland both of those years.
Okay.
I have a question. Dr. Huff, as the guru of the making sense of all these numbers, how much time have you or will you be spending with each principal of the schools so that the teachers can have the results and have a better picture of what they need to do to take the results, you know, that you're giving them to help their students?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we just went all over this presentation with parts of this presentation with the district leadership team, which included principals last week or 2 weeks, week ago, recently, like the last week. And part of their feedback was, they will be having access to this, obviously, but helping provide more tailored data analysis that has this at their school level. So we are going to be working with them on that so they can take that back to their staff.
It'll be specific for their school.
Correct.
Or for certain rooms at their school?
Correct. Yeah, that was one of the requests from the principal. So we will be providing that for them.
I don't want to for Brian to discount the work that he's done, though, because as the scores come in, when our students are taking the tests in the spring, as the scores come in, we're able to see our district data. And so you held at least 2 meetings last spring with principals that principals attended and got their data, and you had provided them with access so they could see all of their data as it was coming in. Mm-hmm. And then also had conversations over the summer and met when school first started. So our principals were prepared when they met their staff at the start of the school year with their school site level data. What we didn't have was state comparison and county comparison. We only had Roland data. But there has been, you can't discount the time that you've spent in terms of preparing the information and sharing with principals, nor we've asked our principals to be here, and they have had an opportunity to be looking at this from late spring throughout the summer and then as well working, disaggregating it. Most recently, as we shared some of these other ways that we now can compare to state and county, they shared a lot of different ideas, as Brian has just talked about, of what additional ways to sort the data could be helpful for them in diving deeper. And one of those is what Mr. Malkin just talked about, is a true cohort match. So the students that they had in third grade to fourth grade to fifth grade to sixth grade, et cetera.
Thank you for not letting him.
So
when the principals go over with the staff, all the results and everything, what steps will be taken next for the schools that did a great job and they went up, and the schools that didn't, what are going to be the next steps to guide them to do better next time or continue to do well?
So as we have done a very thorough and deep dive into the data, there definitely are some areas, you know, it's like going on a treasure hunt, right? You want to find what are the areas that are really showing up as a lot of growth and going really well. We want to, how can we replicate that and how can we share that? And principals, you know, sharing best practices and sites sharing best practices, and then also identifying areas where of concern and areas that are not growing, and what do we need to do? And I think Dr. Zamora will be speaking to that a little bit later on some of our plans for that.
Yeah, I have a question from the are these all the regular students taking the test exclude those English learners or special ed students?
So students that we'll start with English learners. So English learners do take the assessment. They're not counted as part of the results unless they've been in the country for 12 months or longer. Students that are receiving special ed services, it depends on their individual education plan. So some of them take this test, which is the Smarter Balanced Assessment, and then some of them with more severe disabilities take the California Alternative Assessment, which is not represented here.
How about foster kids?
Foster kids do take the test, yes. Okay, so moving on to math. This is same format, so this is showing students that met or exceeded standard, and if we look at our math scores overall last year, 39.99% was a drop over the last year, a slight drop from 40.49%. We're still outperforming the state and county, but if we look at that is an area that that we have dropped, and we're going to dig into that right now together. So this first slide shows, in the same way we looked at ELA data, shows year over year. So again, these are the same grade level each year. So grade 3 in 2015, grade 3 in 2016, 3 in 2017, and 3 in 2018. So if we look at grade 3, there 44% of them met or exceeded in our baseline year, jumped up to 51 for a couple of years, and then fell down, dropped down 3 points for this 2018. Grade 4 jumped up 9 points from their baseline year and has maintained at 44% for the past 3 years. Grade 5 has seen a jump up from 28, 34, 37, and kind of plateaued at 37. And then you can see as we move into the upper grades, one of the trends we notice year over year is that we get in the secondary, then the year over year data tends to be going down. So we've got 42% in seventh grade, 2015, next year's 41, then 39 and 40. So from their baseline year went down. Grade 8 jumped up their second year, but then has gone down to 40 and 36%. And if we look at year over year in grade 11, 36% the first year, 37, and then down to 31% this last year. So secondary math, and we're going to dig into this together, is an area of concern for us. This is not something we're satisfied with, and something that is an area of focus that we are exploring more and doing some more a deep dive into the data analysis. So again, this shows the same four-year change if we look just by year over year in grades. So grade 3, 4, 5, and 6 all had a four-year increase at the elementary level. If we look at the secondary level, we had a 2-point drop in 7th grade, 4-point drop in 8th, and then a 5-point drop in grade 11. So looking at this data a little differently tells us a little bit of a different story, and this is why it's important to look at the data in both ways. If we look at our cohort data, this is our cohort data. Again, these are all the third graders that tested in 2017 in math. 51% of them met or exceeded. And then the next year, all of our fourth graders in Roland, it dropped 7 points down to 44%. Similarly, in grade five, when our grade five students were fourth and then third graders in 2016, all of our third graders in 2016, 51% of them were met or exceeded in math. The next year, all of our fourth graders enrolled in 44%, dropped 7 points, and then again dropped 6 points again to 37% meeting exceeding in grade five. Grade six basically plateaued over the last 4 years. So if we look at grade six, grade five, grade four, and grade three, in 2018, we're about 44% for a couple of years, and then in fourth grade, we're 44%, drop down in grade five, and then jump back up in grade six to 43%. And then if you remember, in grade secondary is where the year over year had gone down. If we look at the secondary math, grade seven and eight, as a cohort, then those groups of students, we see some increase. So grade seven students in 2018, when they were sixth graders, fifth, and then fourth graders, 35 in fourth grade, 34 in fifth grade, 39% in sixth grade, and then 40% in seventh grade. So in both seventh and eighth grade, we see a trend going up if we look at the same, follow the same group of students. Now, if you remember in ELA, when we looked at ELA and compared grade 8 students in 2015 to their score as 11th graders in 2018, it increased in ELA. If we look in math, it's the opposite. So they've gone down, and 40% of those students met or exceeded in 8th grade. All of our 8th graders enrolled in it that year, and then in 2018, all of our 11th graders we dropped 9 points, 31% met or exceeded. So whichever way we look at it, year over year or this cohort match, math is an area of focus for us. When we look at the claim results, again, the claim results show a little bit more specific nature of how our students are performing in concepts and procedures, problem solving, and communicating reasoning. I'm going to jump to slide 20 again. I should have reversed this. My apologies for that. I'm going to jump to slide 20 to show you what the results were last year, so you can see each claim broken down by the three levels, below, near, and above. The claim that is that has been, just like reading has been the claim that we've been, have struggled with, in math, it's concepts and procedures, and many of our benchmarks are also aligned to that for that reason. If we go back to slide 19, the claim area that we see the most growth in, and this is a 6-point jump from 65, is problem solving and modeling data analysis. And this is 65% near or above in 2015, up to 71% this last year. This problem solving and modeling data analysis is assessed through what we call performance tasks. So it's where students have to solve real world problems, synthesize the skills that they learn, and so this is encouraging, this increase in this claim, because I think it reflects the change in instruction that we want to see, where students are engaging in real-world problems. So we are encouraged by this this increase here. I want to take a deeper dive now into our high school scores, because as we saw here, and I'm back at slide 17, when we look at our secondary math scores, when we look at cohort match, so this, the 8th graders in 2015 to 11th graders in 2018. As we talked about before, the high school test is a lot more challenging because you see there aren't any bars in between 8th grade and 11th grade, and that's because we don't assess them in grades 9 and 10. And so that assessment in grade 11 covers Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2. So it covers those three courses. And so one of the questions we asked when we were kind of taking a deeper dive into this was, what are students taking and what math are they taking in grade 11? What courses are they taking, and could that have an effect on what their outcomes are? So what you see on slide 21 is a breakdown of course enrollment last year for all of our students in grade 11 enroll in. And I'm going to start at the top and just sort of walk us through this. So this this chart just shows the percentage of kids in 11, their course enrollment. So we had 1,051 11th graders last year enroll in. And if we start at the top here, 20% of those 1,051 were enrolled in some kind of AP test, AP class. So AP stats, AP math course. 12% were enrolled in a pre-calculus course. 7% were enrolled in college algebra. 28%, so a pretty big chunk, were enrolled in our Algebra 2, which makes sense because that is a on-grade level course. So we would expect the majority of our students in grade 11 would be enrolled in Algebra 2. So the red line here represents all the students that are above the red line are students that would have had access to all the content that was on that grade 11 test at the end of the year. So when you add this up, it's about 67%, about two-thirds, right, of the students were in a course, had taken Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2 by the end of that year. Then we start to go below the red line. This shows the percentage of students in grade 11 that, we'll go through this. 11% were enrolled in Geometry. So those Geometry students took Algebra 1 at some point, and they were enrolled in Geometry in grade 11, so they had two out of the three courses that were on the grade 11 test. Then we look at Algebra 1. 6% of those grade 11 students were enrolled in Algebra 1 in 11th grade. So they were missing two out of the three courses that were on that grade 11 test. This very thin blue line, I didn't put a number on there because it was so thin, was 1%, is applied algebra geometry, and then 14% did not were not enrolled in a math class in grade 11. That does not mean that they did not have access to Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2. I haven't done that analysis yet. We're doing that to see how many of those 14% had actually had taken all three of those courses. Likely many of them had. Otherwise, they would have been enrolled in a course that year. So the question now is then, how did all of these students that are in these courses, how did they perform on the grade 11 test? So we break that down in by course. How did they perform? So what this chart shows is, how did students in AP in grade 11 perform? How did pre-calculus students do, college algebra, and on down the line? So let's start over here on the right. Students who were enrolled in an AP course, and this is not surprising, 89% of them met or exceeded. This is quite high. Pre-calculus, 58% met or exceeded. College algebra, 44%. And then we get into Algebra 2, so 11% of the students that took Algebra 2, their 11th grade, met or exceeded. And then you see 1% for Geometry, Algebra 1, and Applied Geometry. So I think one area of concern, this data here doesn't surprise us. Students that are in AP courses They're doing very well on the Smarter Balance. I think here we're looking at Algebra 2 students that were on track or on grade level, 11% of them meeting or exceeding. So this is kind of where we're digging into now, is that how can we shore that up and how can we help those students along? Again, this number is very, very low, and these are students that are not on grade level, right? They're taking Algebra 1 in grade 11, or they're taking Geometry in grade 11. So again, that is also something that we're looking at. How are we supporting that achievement for students that aren't on track? We wanted to go deeper into this grade this Algebra 1 course. Algebra 1. We have a lot of students who take Algebra 1 in ninth grade. So we wanted to look sort of at the pathway of math success in high school. And when we were looking at the different courses and success criteria, we looked at the students who did not pass Algebra 1 with a C minus or higher. So we were looking at students who failed, and we're calling this fail with a D or lower. We understand that D is not considered failing, but with the new dashboard, C minus, D is considered failing, so C minus is sort of the lowest grade. So we're using that criteria just for this analysis to keep things consistent with the dashboard. So what we found was that students that who failed grade 9 Algebra 1 with a D or a lower, 43% of them went on to graduate, compared to 90.8% of those who passed. Those students were 7 times as likely to drop out compared to their peers, and they were not at all likely to reach meeting or exceeding on grade level SBAC grade 11 test. This is not surprising either. Students who don't pass Algebra 1 by grade 9, it's not a revolutionary finding, but it does help us drill down into what are some of the where can we identify some of students that we can catch them early and help them get back on track to graduating, to succeeding on achievement, being college and career ready. So we have identified this Algebra 1, and it's not just what do we do after that, but even another analysis we're doing is what are some of the earlier indicators in elementary school that might help us understand what would predict student not passing Algebra 1 in ninth grade. So this is sort of like peeling back an onion and trying to really get at how can we find students and identify them and help them early with intensive support. Another thing that we did that we wanted to look at was our TK. So we've invested a lot of money in TK, and Roland has, the board has been very progressive in how they've identified the research behind early education and put money behind the program. So we wanted to show you as a board sort of the return on investment and what does TK do as a program for student achievement and some other metrics as well. So what this slide shows, it shows the grade 3 students, so third graders last year. And I apologize, I don't have that written up here, but this should say third grade students here. And we took the third graders last year and we divided them into two groups. Students who had taken TK 4 years earlier and students that had not taken TK. And we looked at how did they score on the SBAC? Was there a difference in their score? So in other words, the question was, does TK have an impact on Smarter Balance? And so what you see on the light blue columns is the average score for students that were enrolled in TK when they were that age, so 4 years prior. The dark blue shows the average score of students that were not in TK. And the N on that is 144 students that were in TK that year, 800 and 809 students that were not in TK that year. And so the red line shows the cut point for grade level. So the this range here on the left is the full range of SBAC scale score for grade 3. This cut point right here shows what's the level 3. So we talk about meeting and exceeding. The red line shows what is a meeting, what score do they need to meet to be on grade level. So this is the ELA red line, and then the math red line's a little bit higher when they drew up the cut point. So what does this tell us? There's a lot of talking just to kind of get down to the, what are you trying to say, Brian? I'm trying to say that TK has a positive impact on student achievement. Okay, so we see that the average scale score of TK is above grade level cut point. The average that were not in TK were below, and same thing for math. Now, one of the questions we said, well, is that because maybe the groups were different and perhaps the demographics were different? Maybe there were more free and reduced lunch students and the non-TK, perhaps the number of foster students was different. Students, you know, demographics we know are typically underserved and perform lower. And so this, I won't go into the weeds on this, but basically what this shows is that both TK and non-TK students that had been in TK and students had not been in TK were pretty much demographically pretty very similar. So by ethnic breakdown, they were very similar. By students who were enrolled in free and reduced lunch, they were similar. Students who were classified as homeless and students who were classified as foster. So basically what that means is that we can be confident in saying that, you know, any student that it comes to TK, regardless of their background, it has a positive effect on their SBAC scores, at least, and how we measure it. So we were also curious, are there any other metrics, any other outcomes that it had a positive impact on? And so on the left, what you see is the average number of days that a third grader was absent last year, split out by that TK, non-TK. So in this case, we want the bar to be lower, right? Lower is better. So the students who were in TK had an average of 4.4 absences. Students who were not in TK had 5 absences. So there's also a difference in absenteeism, which we know affects student achievement. The last thing we broke out, and these were the three metrics we looked at, is our star reading and star math. And so it's the same story. So our percentile ranks compared to the national norms. Students who were in TK had higher percentile rankings compared to the national sample compared to non-TK. So we just wanted to share that with you just as a follow-up to the investment you have made as a board, that this is a program that clearly is working and impacts on these metrics. And I think we're working on getting some anecdotal statements from teachers, but the students that work with those TK obviously would stand behind this data and would give a lot of just anecdotal evidence of how it affects their learning, not just in TKK, but as they go on through their learning. So let me pause there and then ask, do you have any questions about math?
Thank you for the TK. As I go into classrooms, they look like kindergartners or first graders, what they're doing. So this is great to see all these results. I have a question, though. Are all of these results for only TK students in Roland, or if someone transferred in second grade and you saw that they took a TK class, are they also included in this, or just Roland students?
So these were only students that were in Roland who were also enrolled in a Roland
TK program. Okay, yeah. Thank you. And then for those students, I'm on slide 23. For those students who got a D or lower in grade 9 in Algebra 1, which is on target, Algebra 1 for ninth graders, right? What do we do when they get a D? Do they have a chance to take it in the summer, or do they automatically get to go to the next course?
So I see a teacher like chomping at the bit to answer.
Pardon me?
Yes. So there are multiple ways for them to retake. We have classes during the summer that they can retake and have credit recovery. There are things that teachers do throughout the year. There are intervention classes that provide support for those students. So each school provides different opportunities for students to catch up and make up those credits.
And do they follow through if they decide not to go to summer school? Will they be enrolled in that class again, or will they have to just go on and get lower grades?
Yeah, they would repeat. They continue to take the class until they would pass it.
A D would be able to retake the test, or they'd retake the course, or have to go to the next.
So level. A D is a passing, so they would go on to the next. But for this analysis, we were looking at kids that were just C minus and above.
Okay. And the counselors are in charge of making sure that the kids do take the summer if they need to.
So, yes, they are their point people. It is a school-wide effort, but, yes, the counselors are charged with that.
It's so difficult with the results when you showed us how many kids do not even take a math class, because even if they did, I mean, they hadn't taken it for, like, the 2 years or whatever, the scores are going to be low. They didn't have the practice. And in 11th grade, they're supposed to be taking Algebra 2 on target. So the ones that didn't have Geometry or Algebra 1 yet, do they get any information on Algebra 2 to be prepared for the test, or because they're at a lower level, they don't get any preparation on Algebra 2 information?
Yes, I'm actually going to defer. I don't want to answer without the full.
So students do not have any formal instruction in Algebra 2. When you look at the math standards and the ability in terms of the spiraling of concepts, there are concepts that are touched upon. But I think your question was, do students have the full content of Algebra 2? And the answer is no, if they're not enrolled in that course.
And what is the basis of the test in 11th grade for math? Is it primarily Algebra 2 and Geometry and Algebra 1, all three?
It's all three. It is adaptive. So if a student continues to score incorrectly on an item, the content will go lower with each item, but they're scored on the basis of the full Algebra 1 Geometry and Algebra 2 content.
And in the 11th grade classes, sorry, I'm almost done, do they review 9th and 10th, what should have gotten in Algebra 1 and Geometry? Do they review that in the 11th grade?
It's spiraled, yes.
Spiraled, okay. So it's not, yeah.
And just lastly, on number 19, page 19, the problem solving, outstanding. That's usually one of the hardest things. Students have to read and figure out what to do, and that's really great that our students did great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for all this information. First of all, I have several questions. My first question would be, during the summer school sessions, is the district funding any math classes during summer school? At the high school level, sorry. District funded.
Welcome back, Frank. So we're talking about math content, and so the question you just heard from Ms. Pride is about district funding of summer school courses in mathematics.
Yes, all summer school courses are funded by the district.
At the high school level?
At the high school. No, I'm about math, yes. But except for the Mount SAC courses that we work in alignment with Mount SAC.
The reason I ask that is because as I'm just looking at the course schedules for the Mount SAC summer school program, I noticed Nogales offered no math classes at all. Roland, however, offered three math courses and two study skills courses. So it would be interesting for me to see what the difference is. I mean, did that make a difference that students had access to a math class over the summer at one school? Maybe not at the other school. That's why I wanted to know, were there other courses offered at Nogales?
There were in the previous summer that you're referring to, or this
summer 2018.
Yes, there were math courses offered at Nogales High School. I'm sorry if that information is incorrect.
I'm just looking at the Mount SAC ones, not the district.
Oh,
that's
Mount
why I asked
yes,
if
I'm
there
sorry.
Were district
yes.
funded classes
yes.
that were offered that maybe I wasn't aware of.
Yes. Yes, the district-funded courses, there were math courses offered at Nogales.
Okay. Then my other question is, going back to something that Ms. Friedman said regarding the students who didn't take a math class in, you know, their junior year. So what do we do for those students knowing that they have to take the SBAC How are we, is there a remediation? Is there a boot camp? Is there a refresher course or anything that they get prior to taking the SBAC to just refresh their memory on what they learned their freshman and sophomore year in math classes?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite. I wasn't here when the question was asked.
You know what I'm talking about, Ms. Dr. Huff? At the high school, and I'm just referring to the high school level. Right.
I don't quite know exactly the things that the high schools are doing for to mediate what courses that they're getting for support. But if this is a situation for a student not taking a third year of math and continuing, mm-hmm. More than likely we're dealing with students who are struggling to graduate.
Okay. And then
can I intervene just on that? So part of what Brian had said too, with that 14%, we still are doing the deep dive to truly identify. So are any of those 14% students who've accelerated and taken the three-course sequence starting at a younger age? Mm-hmm. Or are these students who've taken Algebra 1 and Geometry as 9th and 10th grade and then stopped taking Mathematics as a junior? Mm-hmm. They've taken the two-year minimum. That we don't have the answer to that yet. That's a piece that we've been talking about, that we need to dig into that 14%. And answer the question you've just
because
asked.
Because I do understand that they're not required to, if they've taken that sequence already, to take a math class at their junior year. However, if they're taking the SBAC, I mean, how many of us sitting at this table right now could pass the math portion of that exam?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had math in God knows how many years.
Mm-hmm.
So and what we're finding, we were just having a discussion about this today at a meeting at Mount SAC about how the students just taking the summer off, the impact of a student not having math during the summer and then having to jump back into a math class in the fall, how that impacts them. And if the teachers don't do a review of the previous year and just start over, that's an issue for a lot of students, and it shows a lot of failure rate, not just at the K-12 level, but at the community college level as well. So that's a concern as to what are we doing to make sure that that happens, and that's why I asked the question about what's being offered during the summer. I know we can't force kids to take a math class during the summer, but there's other options. Maybe there's a boot camp 2 weeks prior to school starting again just to say, hey, if you're struggling in math, you know, come to this boot camp for a few days to just brush up on it, refresh your memory so that they can be back on track and be prepared for the courses that they're going to take the following year. My other thing is, and this is something that you guys know I'm very, very passionate about, is parental involvement. What are we doing to help the parents to be able to help their kids? If you look at slide number 23, I look at that chalkboard, that whiteboard, and it puts the fear of God in me. Because if my kid came home with that, I would not know what to do with them. I wouldn't. And then when you look at the demographics for our district, how many of the parents that we serve can hire a tutor to send their kids to Kumon? They don't have the resources to do that. So if my kid's sitting at the table and looking at this and saying, I need help, Mom, I need help, Dad, what are we doing? You know, is there something that we can be doing to support parents who maybe, like the students we just talked about, they were maybe good at math in high school, but with all of this new stuff and not utilizing it, you know, we don't add letters when we go to the grocery store. Maybe they just need a refresher, and then maybe they would be able to support their children in doing their homework. And this is at all grade levels. But I know that's a major problem if they can't get help with their homework. And if the tutoring resources and support systems aren't available when they need them or how they need them. And I know that we always say that there's some support systems at school after school. Well, a lot of our kids, again, going back to the demographics of our district, they can't stay after school for tutoring because maybe they have to go home to watch a younger sibling while Mom and Dad goes to work. So what are we doing to support those students and increase the test scores in that way and help them to be more successful? I think I have one more question, then I'll get off my soapbox. Let's see. No, assessment grade 9, 10th student. A little bit about some. Oh, the students who that you talked about who were at the lower levels, I know that you said that some of them maybe because of the classes that they took in middle school were lower levels. So when they came into high school, they're still like a little bit behind as far as like a lot of them don't take geometry at the middle school level because they're not ready. So they have to take that at high school. Did we look at like how many of the kids failed in retaking Algebra 1 maybe? Because that's why I don't know what slide number that was. The one that showed the percentages on the one bar. Yeah, that one. So when you look at the kids who are taking geometry and Algebra 1 in the 11th grade, do we know, have we looked at the data to see how many of those students were taking the class a second time? Or
we have not done that. That's a good next step for us to do.
I think that's all I have for now. If I think of anything else, I'll come back.
I have a couple of questions. On slide 17, where you said we don't test them for those 2 years, I remember, I think it was last year that we disapproved new math books for grade 11. I believe it was grade 11. We just purchased a bunch of new math books.
All grades, not just 11.
Well, I'm thinking of the ones that had the barcodes or the SQ scans on the top where you can get help. Well, I'm pretty sure it was grade 11.
It was 7th through, okay, so it was pre-algebra, algebra, geometry, algebra 2, adoption. So it was, it included all of those grades basically from 7th to 11th because the course sequence goes up to algebra 2 for 11th grade.
Now, is there any way you can correlate the new books that we just purchased with the scores? I realize there's other factors in teaching and demographics and everything else, but making sure we bought the right textbooks, basically.
I'm not quite understanding the
question. We purchased all new textbooks because we thought the old ones weren't meeting or challenging the students. So now that we purchased the new textbooks, I would hope that you would see higher scores.
Oh, I see. We believe so. The new textbooks are for the Common Core State Standards. The new textbooks were adopted through an extensive search by a committee who did piloting for two book series, but also oversaw the review of several books and companies. So we believe these books are meant to align a lot better to the Common Core State Standards.
But the scores don't reflect that.
I think there's a variety of things that we definitely need to look at in regards to how we can improve those test scores.
And then also on slide 19, I don't know, just from common sense, you would think that you would have to have a knowledge of concepts and reasoning in order to do the problem solving. And they excel in problem solving, but they don't excel in the other two. But you think you'd need those other two in order to do the problem solving. To me, anyways, it seems that way. They're skipping right to problem solving and bypassing concepts and reasoning. I mean, it just seems odd.
Yeah, they're definitely connected. The performance test actually that's given when they're asked to do this, because they're testing.
And then on, well, it's page 25. It's not a table number, but the ethnic breakdown and, yeah, that one. Going along with Ms. Pride was saying, the one thing that doesn't measure is expectation at home. And the socioeconomics of the individual, like Ms. Pride was saying, whether a student has to take care of an older student or a younger brother or whatever, that's not being reflected on this. And I would hope that when we do our annual survey, when we do our Rowland Unified School District survey, that we would try to put some questions in there as to expectations of parents of their children. You know, do they expect them to, you know, go to college? Do they expect them to take, you know, advanced placements, you know, courses, and see what, you know, what the expectations are? Because a lot of times expectations determine the success of the student more so than their ethnicity and whether they're homeless or foster or whatever. And as far as helping students, I recently went to the open house that the library had, and they do have homework helper over there where you can call a number, and there's students standing by, college students, that help the students out. Plus, if they go there after school, there's a paid staff member there to help students out in all coursework. So I think sometimes it's just a matter of making the people in the community aware of the resources that are out there to help their students. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question? I'm sorry, I'm back. quick question. Can you explain to me that when students are coming into middle school to seventh grade, how they're placed, how it's determined what math class they're placed in? Are we just looking at their grades from elementary, or is there some other way we're determining how they're placed?
The majority of the students are put into seventh grade math, but there is a test that we offer to all sixth grade and seventh grade students for what is it, essentially an algebra placement test. And if they do well on that placement test, then they move forward to algebra.
Okay.
And from there, they're on an accelerated track.
Okay. And then I promise this is my last question on math for now. Are the district math classes that are offered during the summer at the high school level, are they direct instruction? Or are they online?
Oh, no. They're some of them are using different techniques. I'm going to say, for example, one of the high schools were trying different techniques that involved much more collaborative group structures. But if you're saying if it's face-to-face time, yes, the majority of the classes that are offered during the summer are for direct instruction with teacher-student presence in the classroom.
So does that mean that if they're doing what you said it's collaborative?
Yep.
So is everybody working at a different pace, or is it, when I think direct instruction, I think, okay, turn to page 5, we're all on page 5, and the teacher's at the whiteboard or whatever, and, you know, we're going through everything together.
So when maybe we can set a common understanding for me, at least. For direct instruction, it would be much more teacher-centric in regards to teacher talking. That is a model that is used. Another model that is used is collaborative group structures as a strategy to ensure more students are talking, so they're talking about math more. But in regards to if there is a teacher who facilitates the math discussion in the classroom, that is always going to be the case.
And they're all working, though, pretty much on the same task at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you. Oh.
I'm on slide 15. When you see where the kids are taking tests grade 3, clear up through grade 8, and then all of a sudden there's a 3-year gap, and that's where we're seeing the problem. Why in the world wouldn't there be one more test when kids are leaving middle school, going into high school, which is a different level of, I know it's not you, it's the state, but it seems to me there should be a test at maybe grade either 9 or 10.
Part of the rationale for that is the political context that these tests were created in. It was on the heels of No Child Left Behind, when there was the public sentiment was we're over-testing. And so the idea was, how can we streamline testing? They removed grade 2. They also removed grade 9 and 10 and combined that into an end of high school test to streamline. Locally, at the district level, we do monitor students at grade 9 and grade 10 throughout both of those both of those grade levels using our own assessments in Algebra 1 and Geometry and Algebra 2. But that's some of the rationale for why there isn't a grade 9 and 10 test.
Seems to be a gap there. It's just, mm-hmm. And we don't hear the results, I don't think, of our own district testing, because they're...
So there's not a gap in instruction, but there is a gap in state-required assessment.
My other question is, I remember a few years back, we were haggling with when to give Algebra 1, and we made some changes. Does that seem to have made a difference in anything you remember?
We haven't made... Well, from a state perspective, when the standards changed, eighth grade was the... Algebra was expected in eighth grade, and then with the adoption of the Common Core standards, algebra moved to ninth grade. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, but there was opposition to making that change within our district, and I was wondering if making that change made a difference to our kids and how they're performing.
So our students still have the opportunity to accelerate, as Frank had shared, to be able to. So we have students who have the ability to take algebra at an earlier age if they have through exams and so forth are able to show that they are prepared for that course content. And so we do have a number of students that still take algebra prior to the ninth grade. But ninth grade is the on-grade level math course.
Just to go on the tails of what Mrs. Pride said, trying to get parents involved, not always just because they don't know how to help their kids, but try to get them interested in helping their kids. That, to me, is the biggest problem. We have some parents that will just drive their kids nuts with schoolwork and this and that and study and go here, go there. But then you have some that it's just not as important to them. And those kids, we need to do what we can to get those people interested in helping their kids and see what the payoff is.
I have a question on the math teachers. For lower graders, are same teacher teaching language art and math, right? Until what grade? We have a math teacher teach math, language art teach math.
So the single subject teachers start in grade 7, but we do have some elementary schools that core.
How about 6th grade?
There are some sites that have teachers that focus on teaching math for the whole grade team. They rotate around, but district-wide, it starts in grade 7.
I think why you can explain how you can see the chart. The math is different from language art. Math is some for the lower grade, the first, second grade math, I think most people can teach, but up to fifth or sixth grade, and some teacher himself are confusing sometimes the math and the level. So it, my opinion is when the kids move to fourth, fifth, it's better to have a math teacher to teach math, a single subject teacher, instead of language art teacher and teach the same teacher teach math and language. I have seen some teacher has very difficult for them to learn math and for them to teach math is very hard, and it tried very hard to teach, but still don't get a good result. And so that's why for lower level, third, fourth, and they keep going down until the sixth grade. Maybe sixth grade they have a teacher, then go up, then keep stable. So think about that. Maybe that is the point we can discuss for math teachers, the way to teach.
So that's an excellent idea. It is a much larger conversation. The way that education is currently structured is that by credentials, and so multiple subject credentials teach at the elementary level and single subject teachers teach at the secondary level. It isn't to preclude that you could have a single subject teacher down at grade 4, as you had said. It really would be examining what is the current structure and practices that we have in the district, and how do we want to change that. So it would have two multiple teachers then at the elementary level.
Well, it's a thing about how we can help the kids. Also, we can help teachers. Some teachers very, they struggle. They want to teach them, but sometimes they don't. They don't.
Let me just comment on what you're saying, Mr. Chen. That, you know, I've been into some TK classrooms, and they got all different types of, you know, shapes like triangles, parallelograms, and trapezoids and everything. And those kids are so excited to show a visitor, you know, the names of all those different shapes and everything. And I just think that in the earlier, you know, grades, there's a curiosity there. There's an eagerness to want to learn. And as kids get older, it becomes more of a chore. The curiosity disappears. And I was thinking along Mr. Chen's line that what can we do as teachers, as students get older, to revitalize or keep that curiosity going so they want to learn. They want to be, you know, curious learners and want to learn. And that's really up to the teacher to cultivate that type of learning atmosphere.
And I feel the elementary, from third through six, from the cohort, we did better. And the reason I like at Roland, we have the collaboration meetings when the teachers get together. So math does get difficult in elementary, like fourth, fifth, and sixth. And when they're meeting, they can discuss their lessons and they get to share. Like one teacher might really understand it or the way they teach it, and they share it with their peers. And I've seen that as I walk around the schools when they're in collaboration meetings. So at Roland, I know that we're doing that, which is great. Okay.
So moving on to our significant subgroups, LCFF subgroups. Economically disadvantaged English learners, foster students, and students with disabilities. These first two slides are showing the percentage of students in Roland who are economically disadvantaged, which is defined by students on free and reduced lunch or students who do not have a high school diploma. 44% of them met or exceeded, compared to 40 and 38% at the state and county level. So students that are lower income in Roland are outperforming the same their peers at the state and county level in both ELA and mathematics. So in mathematics, that's 33% of them met or exceeded. Moving on to slide 30. This shows our English learners that on the far right that were in the U.S. more than 12 months compared to the county and the state. So in Roland, 11% of English learners in 2018 met or exceeded. Which is an increase over the past few years. If you look at our students that were reclassified fluent English proficient, this is oftentimes surprising, but it's data that whatever measure we use, whether it's the old CST or the SBAC, we see this true, that students who are reclassified outperform students who are English only or fluent English proficient. In math, we see similar trends for the reclassified students, 47%, which outperforms the state and county, but also outperforms the English-only students and fluent English proficient. You may recall a couple of years ago, Roland was recognized as one of the top five student districts in the nation, or the nation, the state, in EL math performance. And so that performance, it continues to hold. We're at 17% meeting or exceeding. These are English learners that have been here 12 months or more compared to 12% at the county and state. And then our students with disabilities, these are students that are receiving special education services. Similar to past years, scored right at where the state and county are. So our students who are receiving services, 14% of them met or exceeded in ELA compared to 15% at the state and county. And then 11% met or exceeded in math compared to 11% at the county and 12% at the state level. When we look at our foster youth, which is a relatively new group of students that the state has begun to monitor, you can see here the 4 years of data, and I put the number of foster youth here that you could see each year. Last year we had 64 students who had an open case, foster youth case last year, that tested in grades 3 through 8 and 11. 30% of them met or exceeded, which is significantly lower than the district average. We have known this. Research has shown that foster youth are some of the lowest performing subgroups because of issues they deal with around mobility and trauma that they've dealt with at home that impacts their achievement. But it did increase over last year threefold. It's hard to really make a claim about that because the population of foster youth changes so much from month to month. And we look at the math scores too. 12% met or exceeded compared to the previous 4 years. Some of the Roland really is a model district in terms of how they're serving foster youth through the Family Resource Center. Laurel Estrada leads that work, Kevin Despard, in providing really wraparound services for our foster youth, making sure that they have credit recovery, making sure when they come into the district, they've got someone that's helped shepherding them and getting their, if they've got an IEP plan, making sure that they've graduating with reduced credits as that they're entitled to, some of the transportation issues that they're entitled to. So that Student Services Department does an outstanding job of making sure that they have what they need. And then the last thing we're going to look at in terms of the data is our achievement gap by ethnicity. So on the left-hand side shows the overall achievement gap by our major ethnic subgroups in the district. The two largest are Hispanic and Asian, so we'll just kind of look at that together. So overall, in English language arts, the achievement gap between Hispanic students and Asian students is 36 points. So 40% of Hispanic Latino met or exceeded compared to 76% Asian. One question that we might ask is if we were to see how does income affect that? So if we just look at the Hispanic students and the Asian students that were also economically disadvantaged, does that sort of narrow the gap a little bit? And it does narrow the gap by 1 point, no, 2 points, just 36, and then this written down, just 1 second. When we consider economically disadvantaged students, that gap does narrow by 2 points. When we look at the past, just 2 years ago, this gap between Hispanic and Asian in ELA has closed by 10 points. So this year it was 36 points. A couple years ago it was 46-point gap. So that is encouraging to see that gap has started to close in ELA. We look at the same data for math, and 51-point difference between a Hispanic and an Asian student here. And when we control for economic background, that gap closes by just 1 point, so 50-point gap, so not significant change. When we look historically, the last couple of years, this gap has actually gotten a little wider in math, so has increased by about 3 points in math between Hispanic and Asian. Questions about subgroups?
I was just going to say, again, when I looked at this slide, the same thing that I said before came to mind. What are we doing to support not just the student but the parents in supporting their kids? And I think that's that's where we have to keep circling back to. I know our FRC does do an amazing job with our, like we talked about, the foster youth, and I'm very thankful for them and the work that they do. But then when you look at this chart by ethnicity, it all comes back to the households and what else can we do outside of the school environment. One thing, too, though, I wanted to say with these numbers, like I think for the population of black students in our district, isn't it only like about 3%?
Mm-hmm. It's very,
yeah,
very low.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Along with what Angie said, next year possibly we could have the percent of population.
Sure.
So we know, like you said, Hispanic and Asian were our biggest. Well, we could see the number of percent.
Sure.
That would just be a suggestion. On slide 31, you had said 17. We went up, which is great. But last year, do you know what we had last year? Because you said it stayed about
31. Yes, I do know what we had last year.
I was just thinking about comparing it.
Let me get that real quick.
But that's really good that the English
learners.
This is
for English learners?
You uh-huh.
know? Okay.
That have been in more than 12 months.
Yeah. So English learners in mathematics, this is slide 31. In 2016, 10%.
Wow,
better
that's
exceeded.
Terrific.
Last year, 17%. And
okay.
18.7%.
Oh, yay. I'm glad I asked that one. That's really good. Okay. And you said we improved on, the slide 30, and we were at 11.
Uh-huh.
So that one also is just the one before.
Right. So in 2016, 6% of
English. So we went up 5. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. And on slide 34, you said the lowest, but we increased. And then when you said changes month to month, for the foster youth, do you mean like people in and out of the district, and they're counted in this also? So we don't even know if they were in school like the last month when they transferred over to us.
They were here when the testing happened.
Right, but they could have like missed a couple months of school and then came to us.
The average, I think, is 3 changes a year. Foster youth changes schools
okay.
about 3 times a year.
Okay, and that's it. Okay, thank you very much.
I just want to touch on what Ms. Pride, Ms. Ebbingham said earlier and regarding the family involvement. And I'm thinking about the students that spoke at the beginning of the meeting. And they emphasized the need for counselors and the need for mental health, you know, counselors. And I think, you know, not only do we have to involve the parents, but we need to have the support for the students within the school with counselors. And I know we have been increasing that. But I think it's in one area that we really, really need to look at, because these kids today, especially in high school, are undergoing, you know, a lot of mental health issues that aren't being addressed in the community, and yet they're trying to cope in school and cope at home and take standardized testing. And I really think that, you know, we need to put more emphasis on not counselors to get them into college, but counselors to help them get through high school.
Question on the category. There's another group I believe it needs help also. It's homeless kids, and we have a category for foster kids, but the number is small. But there's a large number of homeless kids in our district.
Mm-hmm.
And do we have data, or do we have?
I can get you data on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are kids. Those are kids.
I can't hear you.
Sorry. Yeah, those are here. Yeah, I'm talking about the category of homeless kids. Then do we can get the data for the?
Yes, I can. We can. We will provide you data on homeless performance last
those
year.
Those kids, I need help.
Okay. So the next slides will talk about some of the work in the district that supports student achievement and our core mission, and then some of our next steps. So. We know and believe that teachers are the most important factor in the success of a student's achievement. And so the last few years to support the development of teachers in the district The district has developed and implemented our framework for teaching and learning, focusing on last year clarity of instructional purpose, and this year focusing an additional domain around successful learning for all students, which means, you know, knowing where every student is every day, every week, every month, and being able to provide the support that each individual student might know. Tied to that second focus area is the implementation this year around data talks. And the district has done a lot of work to provide the structure and time for teachers to collaborate around looking at the data. Student work, not just test scores, but also student work that students are bringing, looking at individual student interest in developing lesson plans that are relevant for the students that are in their classroom. So it's not just teachers sitting in their room by themselves, but they have the opportunity, and they do on a monthly basis meet with their grade level team and course content team to look at that data, and principals are leading that work at their sites. We also know that because we know that teachers are the key factor in student achievement, we are implementing a very thoughtful and robust professional development plan that has instructional coaching at the center. So we are in our second year implementing focus areas around mathematical practices, reading workshop, writing workshop, inquiry, and then lesson design at the secondary level. And it includes some, you know, pupil-free days where teachers are getting direct instruction and training. But the core, the most effective part of the professional development in Roland over the last year and a half or last few years and then going in the future is the support that the instructional coaches play in helping implement what they learn. So the instructional coaches go into the classrooms. They co-plan with the teachers. They co-teach. They model lessons. What does it look like? And so they have really come alongside the teachers. And you see the changes. You see the changes in instruction over the last year. So we're in year two now of this, and we already see the impact of that change in instruction in the classroom. As you know, we're also now all schools are fully implementing PBIS, Positive Behavioral Intervention and Supports, which recognizes that we want to explicitly teach the behaviors that we want students to do in school, and systems that will recognize when they are doing that, and also systems that will support students that are not following those expected behaviors. Building on many of the successes last year from extended learning, it continues to grow. One of those is our Saturday school learning program that was very successful last year that was shared with you that has already launched this year earlier than last year at Northam Elementary, and we have six more scheduled Saturday learning sessions, and they've been very very successful. Students love attending those. Dr. Colella has been organizing that work, and students have really loved being able to come to school on Saturday, which is remarkable. And then also intervention throughout the year. So in addition to our summer school program, which is also very popular, our intervention during the school day, intervention after school, tutoring programs that are provided at all of the sites. The focus on personalized learning to address the needs of all students continues to develop. It has been an area that we have explored. This year, the way you see that showing up is around schools that are really asking the questions around who are these students as an individual in front of me. So as teachers began the year this year, many of the schools, in addition to looking at the test scores, we're also looking at what kind of data can I collect on what do my students enjoy doing? What are their passions? Who are they as people? So as they develop lessons, they're relevant. to the students that are in front of them, which may change from year to year. There's also, as you walk the schools, you see an increased focus on relationships. We know that when a student, particularly at-risk student, is connected to at least one adult on campus, they have a much higher chance of all the metrics, graduating, succeeding, higher achievement. And so it is remarkable to see the change in the culture and how the students even report sort of a greater sense of connection to their sites. So that's part of the personalized learning. It also takes place in instruction, so small group instruction. You walk around and you see a dramatic increase in the amount of small group instruction that's happening, which allows teachers to really personalize the instruction to the students that are in front of them and give them what they need. In terms of next steps, we recognize that these standards and the assessment data that we just saw reflects an entirely new way of assessing students. The rigor is dramatically higher. The expectations that we have on students now have dramatically increased. And so we as a staff are also examining our own mindsets around what do we believe around student achievement, and making sure that our mindsets are such that we expect all students to exceed. We know that students will rise to the occasion, and when we have high expectations, they will rise to that occasion. We also know that it's part of that is changing our behavior and changing our practices. So we part of these next step is just to continue to ask, what do we need to change in our instruction to give all students the opportunity to succeed in these very challenging standards and very challenging assessments.
A while back, we approved the LCAP, and within the LCAP, we had our plans on what we're going to be doing and allocation of funds and et cetera. Now that we have these scores, do we go back and revisit that plan? And because I know at every board meeting, there's always requests for consultants to do specialized training or to send staff to outside training. Hopefully, that'll be looked at to see if it's relevant to our test scores and what would help improve our test scores, not training for training's sake.
So yes, we have looked at the LCAP and pulled it out. Maddie and I were just having that conversation. I don't know if that was yesterday or today, regarding that crosswalk and that comparison piece. And you are correct. Whenever we do bring an item forward to the board, it is for purposeful work. It is tied with our test scores, because most of that is tied and connected to, from district funded, is tied to the work that Brian just spoke about with addressing the focus areas and the training with around our focus areas.
Okay, one last thing. Thank you, Brian, for Dr. Huff, for this. It was really helpful. One thing I would ask, and I mentioned this before, if we can just get like a one-page executive summary. Not to go into a bunch of detail, but to say these are the hot points that we need to look at, these are the points we're doing well on, it makes it a lot easier than when I go through this, rather than having to develop that summary in my head as I go through this. But just to have a one-page cover sheet, the executive summary.
Sure. Thank you.
This is maybe not a question, but an expectation that I know it's been recognized that we've done a lot of professional development. We've got experts from everywhere in helping us. I see a lot of good things going on in the classroom, but I don't see the students responding to it, and I cannot figure out why. That's your job. So I would like reports more often to know how things are going. If you're testing, I'd like a report every quarter. That's why we're here, is to teach students. I'd like to know, Dr. Huff, what's going on when you meet with the principals and what they're going to implement in their schools to help the classrooms that are weakest in certain areas. We don't mind putting the money up for it, but I don't want to just be throwing money out there if it's not working and we're not seeing results. I understand we want more than just test results. But I was elected to lead an educational system. And if we're not cutting it, we've got to take a real hard look. I know last year Julie implemented something that was really good, and that this year is probably the first year you're using it. What is that thing that I say it looks like an astrology? It looks like the solar system. And I'd like to see some of the schools concentrate on math where they're really weak in math, even if they want to do reading workshop or writing workshop. I'm perplexed, and I want you to be perplexed. I wish we could go out to another district that had very similar demographics, that similar to ours, that have turned it around and picked their brains and see some of the things they've done and that type of thing. But I'm hoping that your system, Dr. Mitchell, I know you were kind of, it was forced upon you sort of late in the game to get it going last year, but I think it's the right thing to do to look at each and every student and expect every student to improve, even if it's a little bit every day. That's the way to get there. You look at the school and district all in one big lump, and it doesn't look so bad. But we've got to take each student and make sure we bring them along. Some of the schools are doing some great things. They're taking kids that need the most help. They're putting them in groups and working, giving some concentrated help to those kids while the others can help each other. So anyway, that's what I'm looking for, and I'd love to see some of those things happen.
Thank you for a great presentation, like always. I know you mentioned the TOSIS and the district coaches are outstanding. I see all the teachers very thankful for the help, and I've seen them in the classrooms teaching. What about the teachers that kind of need that help and they don't ask for it? Would a principal say, come in and intervene, or what happens in that case?
All of us know this answer.
That's why relationships are so critical. Mm-hmm. The coaches have really, I would say, for the most part, developed very strong relationships. And I actually just had a conversation with a coach the other day saying, I've got this one. I know if I can find other ways to connect with them, I can get into the classroom more. We can't force a coach onto someone, mm-hmm. But we can certainly reach out and provide them with resources and provide them with supports where they start feeling the success, and then they do want the coach to come in more. So that's how we're trying to get in through the back door, so to speak. But it's really about relationships and the trust that the coaches have with the teachers. And for the most part, like you said, Donna, you've been into the rooms, they really enjoy the time with the coaches and wish they had more time with the coaches.
Mm-hmm. That's what I hear from other teachers, what they say. Oh, that's good. Okay. And then the interim assessments. Do all schools look at that? Because that's a clue on how they're going to do it on the test. So teachers should know, okay, well, this student needs to do better, or they need to work on this one, or even when they collaborate. Do all schools have their staff by grade level look at that and say, oh, this is a key that our whole grade level needs to work on or something?
So the expectation is they are meeting monthly for mm-hmm. data talks. And so part of that, as the interim assessments are given, that is data they look at. But they also look at other data, data that's from units of study that they're giving at different times. But that is part of the data they look at.
And so all the principals will go over with their staff with the results. And then there's individual results per teacher, per class, and all of that. For a class that has lower than the rest of the grade level, what will happen? Like, who will be able to help them to try to improve? Besides the coach and all that, that's when the coach will come in and help them?
It's the principal.
Principal, yeah. Okay.
So when you're looking at a student, we're looking for growth. And if we're seeing that a classroom is not showing growth, then that's a conversation that the principal's having with the teacher. And then offering services of the coach and going and looking at other programs and working to see it's part of that teacher's performance is students need to be growing. So you can't always compare one teacher to the next because they're working with different groups of students.
Definitely.
However, there should be growth within a given classroom. And so that's a conversation that principals have with individual teachers.
Okay, and the schools that performed very well, will those principals be sharing what they did so well with the other principals? Yep. And then yes, you were going to say.
So some of the work that Educational Services will continue to do is dive deep into the data. And part of that is to be able to give the true cohort data to our schools as well as classroom data. When we do that, that will also give us highlights of areas of success. So where do we see success? And it'll help us go in there and talk about what practices were put in place and can we replicate those practices. That's information that I think all principals want. What can we replicate within our school district with our demographics? Another thing that will provide for us are areas of needed improvement and how can we strategize to support a school or a specific content that needs that additional support. So I think that you're right. Principals do want to know what's working out there and what can they replicate within their school.
And likewise, the principals that have the schools that went down there, what kind of help are we going to offer them or what would be the next step that the school's scores went down?
One of the things that we're going to be doing this school year is we've identified a subset of schools that need that very individualized support. So the role of Educational Services is to remove barriers, provide individualized support to these schools that will help them reach their goals and reach their vision for their school. It's work that we're starting on right now, and we were just in the beginning conversations, but we have identified that subset of schools that will get a very systemic look at what they're doing and co-craft a plan with the school. It's not something we're going to impose, but it's something that we will collaborate with the site principal and the site leadership team to make sure that they're getting what they need. And so the plan for one school will not look like the plan for another school. So we do plan on being very focused, intentional, and deliberate.
Okay, thank you. My last question is for staff development, professional development. Do you ever ask the teachers what they want or what they need to be able to be more successful in the classroom before saying, oh, we're going to have this and this? That's my last question.
So I can defer that to one of our directors, but that is part of the process, and that's how they came to select their area of focus.
This raises another question listening to Ms. Friedman here. You mentioned that you can go down to the classroom level with these scores. Do we look at the students' official grade that they're getting in the classroom and how they did on the standardized tests to make sure that we don't have like grade inflation where kids are getting A's but they're failing on the standardized test? Do we compare that at all?
We haven't done that at a district level. Mm. I know there's been some different work around examining grading practices at sites right. to different degrees over the years, but we haven't run a correlation on grades as they compare to state testing.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead. Just what Mr. Melkin was saying. So does anybody look at that? Because as a former teacher, I remember giving D's and of course, they did not do good on the test, but the teacher before them, they got A's and B's, and clearly they were not. So I was wondering he brought up a very good question that they have to be, if they get an A or B, then they should be able to be passing and be met or, met the standard or above. And if that's not happening, can somebody check that? Does the principal ever look at that or what?
So that's part of the work, too, that we've been having the conversations around standards-based report cards. That would be more aligned with our state standards. But as Brian had shared, to date, we have not done a correlation of grade to a standardized test score. We have not done that yet.
So is that something we could look into?
I And this year we will be working on our report cards and how to align them to the standards at the elementary level.
First of all, I want to say thank you, Dr. Huff, for putting all this together. It was a great presentation. Thank you for all of you being here to answer our questions, and for all of the principals and assistant principals and other staff for being here to hear everything. And I know it was hard to sit there and not say anything. But I do want to thank you all for being here. As a discussion, you can take that to your site. One of the things I want to say is that over the last 2 weeks, I've met with five local K through 12 school districts in our region, and everybody is feeling the same way we are. I did not meet with one district who said to me, oh, our test scores are fabulous. We're just doing phenomenal. We don't need your services anymore. No, it was quite the contrary. And so I know a lot of people want to think, oh, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. When we look at this data, the sky is not falling. There's some clouds. In some areas, there's a little bit of drizzle as well, but it's not falling. I think we have a long way to go before we can say that the sky is truly falling. So I just want to put that out there because, yes, we all recognize that there are a lot of issues and concerns, and we are all concerned about it, every single one of us. But we're in the same boat with a whole lot of other people at this point. And we have to also look at the fact of how long we've been doing the SBAC test and what impact Common Core had on the transition to Common Core had on it. So there's a lot of other external factors that are playing a role too. So I just want, you know, people in our community to keep those things in mind as they look at the presentations and hear what we're saying and hear even the concerns that we have and how we're talking about addressing it. Okay. So with that said, couple of questions. What is our attendance looking like in our district right now? We haven't gotten a report on attendance. We haven't asked for one note, I will say that, in a while. What is our attendance looking like right now?
When I looked at it, student attendance was about 97.4%.
Okay, so then we can't say that that's a big factor. Okay, that's a good thing. One of the things that Mr. Lohman mentioned while he was speaking during his comments was about, said something about class size. I'm sorry, I didn't catch all of it. But is class size a factor when we look at math and English? Any of you guys can answer. Do we think that's a factor, especially with math?
So when you have a conversation around class size in any subject area, obviously our conversation today was around math and English, but the research says repeatedly that student performance on standardized tests do not change until class sizes are 13 or lower. So when you're looking at the numbers, as a classroom teacher, principals and so forth, everyone would welcome, I'm sure, the opportunity for lower class sizes. But when you look at the data, even when the state of California was implementing 20-to-1, there was not a change that was noted. What research has said is class size of 13 or lower is where you see a significant change in student performance.
Okay. And just to echo what my colleague said about the professional development, that's one area where over the last few years I've heard a lot of positive feedback. I think that the teachers are really appreciating the fact that they have input into it and that they're feeling like the professional development now is valuable and not just a check-the-box program. So that is something that I feel like we're doing very well at. The framework, this is the second year that we're in with the framework.
Correct.
One of the things I remember when we first introduced this and we had the first kickoff and everything, that everybody was super excited about it. The teachers were super excited. Are they still super excited about it?
Well, I haven't asked if they're super excited about it. I think
okay,
I'll
ask Mr. Lohman later.
that'd be a fair assessment. Yeah. And I'm not sure that excitement is necessarily it.
Is there still buy-in?
I would say yes. The work, I think we all need to recognize the work is going to get much more difficult. So the first year of anything is easier, but it is going to get much more difficult when you dive deeper into our focus areas, diving deeper into the framework for teaching and learning and the work that is actually happening. And the expectation of seeing student growth at the end of every day, week, month, trimester, semester, and at the end of the year. And how are we assessing that? How do we know that students are growing? Right. And then needing to individualize instruction. So there's heavy lift ahead.
Okay. And then the final thing I just want to say, Dr. Zamora, I know I've had an opportunity to speak with you briefly, and we exchanged some ideas about a couple of things. And I know you haven't said much tonight because you're new still. I've only been with us for a few months. But I do look forward to hearing some of your ideas and how you want to move forward on making next month's presentation a little happier.
I just have a suggestion, and take it for what it's worth. But, you know, when I went out to the Saturday, I'm calling it a science camp, whatever you want to call it,
Exploration Academy.
That was a fabulous thing. Those kids are so excited. If we could take five kids that are on the cusp that aren't too interested in learning and bring them along and try to get them to one of those, maybe it would help turn them around.
That's the whole audience. That's who we invite to Saturday Exploration Academy. So we've taken your idea and done more than five. So the invitations go to our at-risk population to have them come and experience school in a different way. And you're right, they are very excited and very engaged in enjoying that learning. And so part of what we're looking forward to doing is seeing is there, you know, one day doesn't change the trajectory of student success, but it could put a student on the right path.
But there are other kids that are not at risk that attend also, right?
There are some, because siblings are attending and other students. We have staff that's there. We want those classes to be full. But it is the opportunity for us to address our at-risk population.
Are they actually calling families, trying to get them to come? Is that how you're getting them to sign up?
Yes.
Okay.
Real quick on that note, see, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I have forgot. When you look at that Science Academy and you take that same energy and put it into a Math Academy, then maybe that's what I was talking about as far as that refresher, that boot camp type, you know, learning situation, just to keep it all fresh in their heads. So if it's a way to do it and make it fun and not seem like it's school, that would probably help as well.
So it's all wrapped around one learning experience so that the entire day feels like it's very fluid and there's continuity from everything. But it encompasses math, language arts, and science. So it has all the subject areas. Right now, we started something new with this one because we expanded the Saturday Exploration Academy. So now we're doing Kid Inventors. And so the students are inspired and to realize that other kids just like them have invented different things and that they can invent as well. And so the entire day is wrapped around that learning experience. And it starts out, there's a lot of reading, a lot of math, and then there's some science integrated in there. And then this time there's some engineering. So the students get the opportunity to go through the engineering design process and make those relationships to the inventor. And because it's a kid inventor, they walk away believing exactly what we wanted to have them believe, that they too can be inventors now. So it's all wrapped around an experience, and it does encompass all of the different subject areas. And what's really exciting, I have to say, is that the math that you were questioning specifically about math, this year, the teachers who are leading the learning in the classrooms, they're implementing the math that they've been learning, the new math, the new approaches, the new bits of learning they've been learning through the professional learning days. They're implementing that on Saturdays and practicing with different grade levels, different students all across Roland, and then developing their expertise and then taking that back into the classroom. So it'll be exciting to see how that grows. And then they try these new ideas, and they go back and share them at their school sites. And so it's starting to really grow across that way as well.
I have seen math classes, even this week when I was going to classrooms, how they're in groups, and the kids are doing all the talking, and the academic language is amazing. And so I think it's great, and that you do see that enjoyment. They're having fun while they're learning math. But you asked about class size and if it's different in language arts and math. And I'd like to know, I know you said that it doesn't show any results, but is that because they took a class of 30, then they took a class of 35, and they decided, oh, yeah,
they were the same, or how could they come up with that?
So I didn't, the question that I was responding to wasn't separating out math and language arts,
but overall,
just in general.
Overall.
So I personally did not do the research.
I knew
that. I have read a lot of
research. I knew that.
So I would have to go back and refresh my memory in terms of what was the control groups and what was the information.
So I have to disagree with that research only because, I'm sorry, because when I've had 35 students, yes, they've all gone up, let's say in math for sure, because I really love math, but if I would have had less, you have less behavior problems, you have less, you know, you have more individual time with them, and that should be more of a research than saying, so I do believe, and I'm sure other teachers would.
Well, we'd all believe it, yeah.
That lower class size should be able to help, and maybe they all went up and they felt like it didn't matter, but maybe they would have went up a lot more if the class size was less. You know what I mean? Like, okay, they're saying that it doesn't make a difference, but if there was a lower class size, I am sure that those kids that did very well because they met the standard, you would have more kids meeting the standard because there's less kids to work with and you can work with them more individually. Okay, I have to say that. Sorry.
I have a question about that.
Okay.
So you think a class of 30 students that all were in need of special attention would make better progress
than a class of 35? Definitely.
Yes, because really? You have individual time with them. You don't know what it's like to have
35. They all need more.
No, but you have 35 kids sitting there, and you need to give them all individual attention. One starts behaving bad, then it trickles or whatever. And then you're trying to teach everything. But if you have 30 kids, now you have less, and you can control, like, even the small groups. If you have five small groups, you know.
I'm together. Not the teacher here, so.
Yeah, but it's different when you stand in front of a class all day and you have 35 or 32 or 30 kids. It's totally different, and I believe it does make a difference. And I'm surprised a study would show that. That's what I'm thinking, that maybe the study said they did good, but they would have done a lot better if you had less kids because you have less to control, you have less to teach, you have more one-on-one or small groups to walk around to talk to instead of having an extra group. In the classroom, you should be able to see when you have smaller. When you go in a classroom and there's a whole bunch of kids, it's a lot difficult. It's a lot harder than having less
I'll
kids.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay, class size. Lower class size is excellent.
Reflecting back on when my son was at Alvarado and was taking algebra there, they had a program called Math Counts. Do we still have that? Where it was competition, and the kids within Alvarado would practice, and then they'd compete against other schools. And it really accelerated their learning of math because the competitive nature of it was like a sports for them, you know, a sport activity. And to this day, I still get letters from Math Counts addressed to my son. But Mr. Price is the one that at that time ran the program, and Burl Hunt was the principal, but... It was a great way to get kids involved in math in a competitive way.
So, yeah, Math Counts operates like Science Olympiad in terms of looking at math. And so Karen is over here nodding that, yes, it is still there. And so, yes, I can say yes.
I'm sorry, yeah. The SBAC, both CAA and all tests are computer-based. So, but not... Every kid has a computer at home, but they have a computer at school. And the way the test, the format, and the way the test is different from the test they take every day. So, is that familiar? The kids, how are the kids familiar with the computer, the skills, or the computer, the way the aspect maybe contribute to the score? That may be why the socioeconomic lower families, the kids, they don't have computer at home, then they got lower grade. So how do we...
So I will defer to Dr. Huff on that, but that is something we've been discussing for the last 2 weeks. Right. Dr. Huff and I have been talking about making sure that the tool is not in the way of demonstrating what our kids actually know.
Right.
That would be not good for the kids. So definitely a conversation we've been having, and I'll let him talk about how we've been preparing the kids here in Roland Unified.
Well, one of the reasons we give the SBAC interims is to give students exposure to the way the test is formatted and the tools that they can use. So we do that twice a year.
Do we predict the kids will practice the way.
And they they practice.
How often? How much?
It varies. I mean, at minimum, there are two trial runs that the whole district goes through. Mm-hmm. We're in the middle one right now. Mm-hmm. So, in the end of October, the last 2 weeks, mm-hmm. all the students that are taking the SBAC go through a practice test. Take the interim, which is like a practice for the summative. Mm-hmm. And then again in January. Throughout the year, teachers will pull up tools and show and just do a think aloud about how to walk through the different tools. It is an area that we're looking at expanding and sort of more making more systematic mm-hmm. in terms of every teacher going through the same process mm-hmm. in terms of giving students exposure to the kinds of tools that they need mm-hmm. At the end of the year.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Huff.
Yeah.
Thank you for your team for preparing the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Any more questions?
Yes. I guess one last one. What's the plan now? You're going to go back. You're going to look at the data at school site, classroom, et cetera. When can we hear back from you next on this as to update?
So we will provide information through Dr. Mitchell. I think at the soonest next Friday, it would give us plenty of time to sit down and talk about some of the approaches we're going to take this school year to support our teachers and support our principals with the work that they are doing. But definitely I agree that we will be sending you more updates on a more consistent basis so that you know what we're working on. Definitely the first step is to go back and disaggregate the data even further, like I said before, by true cohort and by classroom teachers so that we can provide that to our principals. Another approach that we're going to take is making sure that all of our professional development continues to infuse the content standards and the teaching practices that are high leverage to impact student achievement so that the conversation on the standards is infused and consistent with the professional development that we're providing because our teachers are definitely benefiting from that, as well as the claims and the instructional shifts that Common Core calls for.
Thank you very much. I need a motion and the second to adjourn the meeting.
I'll move.
I move. Please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. 6:51. Thank you.